Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig Garber, and I want to wish you and your family a very happy holiday season and a peaceful and healthy new year. I also want to take this opportunity to thank you very much for all your support. This has been a great year for us, and I'm really excited about all the cool new things we'll be doing next year and all the great guests we already have lined up. We'll actually be dropping episode number 400 of fresh new content coming up soon on January 15th, and I never could have done this without you, so thanks. This week, the first week of January 2019, I'm taking some time off. During this time, we'll be rebroadcasting some of the most popular episodes of Everyone Loves Guitar. In addition, at the beginning of each of these shows, I'm going to give you some brief commentary about my recollection of the overall interview experience I had with whatever individual we're airing that day. Again, sincere thanks for listening and for all your support. If you ever want to get a hold of me, go to the contact tab on everyonelovesguitar.com website. I'm fairly inundated with email, to be honest with you, and with work in general. So while I may not be able to answer your specific message, I do read all the messages and comments I get. Thanks again for your support. Now let's get busy with today's show. Today's Greatest Hits episode is also one of my personal favorite episodes. It's with the one and only David Grissom out of Austin, Texas. This was a pretty intense episode for David as well. He talked about a lot of things there, and he's generally a guy who keeps things very close to the vest, but he talked about the loss of his mom. He talked about, you know, the gig with Mellencamp, and, you know, very candid about their relationship. He talked about, you know, hitting rock bottom and getting sober, and, you know, how this gift has been such a gift for him. And he actually emailed me after the interview came out and thanked me. And he was, you know, he said he doesn't usually talk about stuff like that. And he said it was great because, you know, especially he talked about the loss of his mom. I think his sister called him up. And, you know, one of the nice things is when people say, hey, I listen to this interview with a guy I played with for 30 years and I learned things about him I never heard before. Well, in this case, David called me up and said, my sister called me and said she learned things about me that she never knew. So that's a really, you know, meaningful thing. And I genuinely appreciate that. David's a tremendous player. He's a writer. His songs have been recorded by Trisha Yearwood, John Mayall. He was with Storyville that he wrote for them. So he's pretty much played with everybody and he's a great player, truly a master, really unique style, and an extremely popular player. So check this interview out. I know you're going to like it. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. I got a tremendous, really unique player, really, really sweet guy as well. We're with David Grissom today. David's toured and recorded with artists such as John Mellencamp, Joe Ely, Storyville, the Allman Brothers Band, the Dixie Chicks, Chris Isaak, Robin Ford, the Fabulous Thunderbirds, Montgomery Gentry, Ringo Starr, Buddy Guy, Bob Schneider, and John Mayall, among others. David's songs have been recorded by Trisha Yearwood, Leanne Womack, John Mayall, Shannon Kerfman, Storyville, and more. He's been featured several times in Guitar Player, Guitar World, Musician, and Vintage Guitar magazines. And hey, it's David Grissom. He's all over the place. Come on, man. He moved to Austin in 1983, joined Texas legend Joe Ely's band in 1985, touring and recording nonstop until 1991 when he joined Mellencamp. He made three records with John Mellencamp, touring extensively from 91 to 93. After Mellencamp, David went back to Austin to form Storyville, the band that included the Double Trouble rhythm section and powerhouse vocalist Malford Milligan. Storyville cut two CDs for Atlantic, and since 2000, David's divided his time between recording sessions, including the last three Buddy Guy records, and touring with the Dixie Chicks from 2003 to 2007, playing hundreds of live gigs and recording and producing his own CDs and doing a lot of studio tracks out of his home studio. In 2007, Paul Reed Smith Guitars introduced the DGT, David's signature model guitar, and in the fall of 2013, PRS released two of David's signature amps. And I got to tell you, I can't tell you how many players I've spoken to that play PRS. Uh-huh. Like almost 100% of them have said, the David Grissom PRS is the best one. I mean, almost, it's almost 100% that that's how, or say, man, I had a chance to buy the David Grissom when I screwed up. That's what I should have gotten. Something like that. So, David's released four CDs. He's currently working on his fifth CD right now, which he's going to have out sometime this year. Man, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hey, you've got a very unique style of playing, and there aren't too many people that can pull off a unique style and make it work so consistently. Another guy that comes to mind that has a unique style is Joe Perry. It's really hard to say, like, you kind of hear the influences in what you guys are doing, but the way you express them is really proprietary, you know, very unique to you. And I was curious, where did you draw your biggest influences from, just specifically that helped you develop this unique style? And also, was this deliberate? Like, is this something that you worked on to be expressive of you, or is that just like randomly how it came out?
Well, it definitely wasn't deliberate when it was happening. I think, you know, as after time, I got to a certain point in my career and I realized, yeah, I do have something. I do have a sound. People kept commenting on that. And then I tried to be mindful of that and work, have that work to my advantage. But initially, I'd love to say that I had a master plan when I was 13, but it was a little early for that. And, you know, I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, and it was before YouTube. It was before the internet. It was not, Louisville was not a big music town, and you really just, it was sort of catch as catch can. And I mean, I can remember as far back as I mean, when I was a kid, I fell asleep with the AM radio on. I was attracted to music in a way that I wasn't attracted to anything else really. And I can remember, even now, this is such a huge thing for me, is the songs that had like a sonic signature, or that made me feel a certain way, or had a stamp on them that was unique, being attracted to that. So, I mean, I would fall asleep with the radio on every single night, you know, for as far back as I can remember, being 5-6 years old.
Little AM transistor with the 9-volt batteries, man.
right next to the bed, you know, yeah, and, you know, Wacky Radio, WAKY in Louisville. And there was a DJ named Weird Beard. And he would play all kinds of stuff that, you know, it was all over the map back then. And from Motown to, you know, rock, just everything. You know, it wasn't like, it was more top 40, and top 40 was a lot more inclusive then. But
yeah.
Really, when I heard the Beatles, and the first record I ever bought was Revolver. And I can remember to this day, my mother, I was hounding her about it. And she called my father at work and said, could you possibly stop and get this record for David? And I know he bought it at Vine Records downtown in Louisville. And it was until he walked through the door, I didn't know if he was going to have time or if he was going to do it for me or not. And we put it on. He walked through and I got it. And I mean, just the smell of taking the plastic off of it, and I put it on. And when Taxman came on, it was just like, oh, you know, there it is. And almost right then and there, it was like you're on a boat and you set your course for, all of a sudden, you know what your sign, you know, what your journey is, where you're headed, and you just point in that direction. And I felt like that was the moment that somehow I knew.
How old were you then?
Well, I would have been 8 or 9.
Wow.
Possibly 10.
You didn't play around, man. First record, Revolver. That's pretty intense.
Yeah, I know. I got lucky on that one. And my first concert I went to was Santana. No, Steppenwolf.
Holy shit.
My father took me to Steppenwolf.
That's pretty cool.
That was the last time he took me to a concert.
First
from then on, he dropped me off, and then, you know, we'd I'd go with somebody and one parent would pick up or one would drop off. And so that was, you know, that was sort of the start of it. And at the same time, my dad listened to, you know, he had an 8-track, he had 8 tracks, and he would listen to Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, country music. Mm-hmm. And I heard, you know, the Waylon Jennings, he played this Waylon Jennings 8-track every night, you know, and there's sort of a demarcation point in there. When I was 10, my mother died. So I know that I got Revolver. It had to be 10 or younger. Hmm. But after my mother died, he would play this Waylon Jennings 8-track every night. And there was a song on there called Delia's Gone. And I can just remember walking into the room where he was playing and just like you could cut the sadness with a knife.
That was his helping. That was his grieving.
Yeah. I mean, he'd sit, you know, listen to that. And, but there was a song on that 8-track. I'm sure it was, I think it was the same 8-track. If not, he probably had every Waylon Jennings record, called Only Daddy That'll Walk the Line. And there's a guitar solo on there that Wayne Moss played. And I can just remember hearing that solo, and in the back of my brain, it was like, wow, you know. And then at the same time, I kind of found out about Doc Watson, and a kid in my neighborhood got a banjo. And so we started sort of playing some bluegrass stuff together. So it was just this, you know, mixture of things. And I would go down, you know, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but up to about the time I was 11 or 12, this is what was going on in my house. Hmm. And then, again, my father said, you might want to watch this show that's going to be on PBS tonight about the greatest unknown guitar player in the world. Oh, and I started to play guitar. And it was Roy Buchanan. Mm. And it turned out that my dad watched it for about 5 minutes and then lost interest. But I got Roy's first album, his first 2 records. And, you know, later I looked back on it and there were so many things about his playing at that time and on those 2 particular records that influenced me, not the least of which was the way he mixed all these styles together. And again, I wasn't thinking, wow, he's taken all these different styles. It just, in my subconscious, I think, I absorbed the idea that you could play country licks in blues. You could, you know, there were no rules for him, so why should there be rules for me? And the beauty of no internet, no chat rooms and blogs and all that is that there wasn't anybody there to tell me that that was not cool. And I see that being a big impediment to, you know, people developing their own voice right now. So I'm very grateful for that. It also forced me to develop my ear more. I had to go learn things on my own, just picking up the needle on the record. Yeah. And learning the lick, you know, it wasn't like, here's the video, how to do it, and here's the fingering and everything. It was, and, you know, and a lot of times I would learn things differently than they were actually being played, which worked to my advantage. They sounded the same, but I got there in a different, you know, a different route. So it was, you really had to look for stuff in Louisville to find things. And, you know, I started hanging around with some guys that were really into blues, and I got really heavy into B.B. King. And again, you know, the first record I got was Live at the Regal. I mean, it's the pinnacle for me. And, you know, Butterfield, Magic Sam, Albert King,
Bloomfield, I'm sure.
Pardon me?
Bloomfield, it was in there, I'm sure.
Bloomfield, especially on the first Butterfield record, you know. Blues with the Feeling. I mean, it was just, you know, wonderful. But it was BB and Albert King that really were the ones for me that really, you know, just over and over and over again, I couldn't get enough of it. And I, you know, of course I got into Hendrix and the Stones and, you know, but I also, you know, then I started listening to jazz, and I got, you know, found out about Wes Montgomery, and then I got into the real blues-based jazz players, Kenny Burrell, Grant Green.
Grant Green's, yeah.
You know,
fantastic.
The George Benson blue, the CTI records that I got initially, Body Talk and Beyond the Blue Horizon. Those harmonically were more. I was able to understand them better before, you know, going headlong into West Montgomery and Coltrane or something like that. But all those things just sort of, I just thought there was good music and bad music and soulful music and music that didn't touch me. And so it was a matter of all those things is just mixed together.
Well, it's interesting, even this cut on you said Taxman, sonically, that's a very different record from almost everything the Beatles have done, you know. So I could see that you were just allured to different, you know, your influences were in those differences of sounds, the way sounds were, which actually leads me as a good leaping point to the next question, because my next question is, you're really adept at using effects, specifically like when you use distortion, echo, and maybe some reverb. When you play, it's almost like you're playing specifically to take advantage of those effects. And I don't think most players do that. I think they use effects to change the sound. But you're kind of taking that to another level and playing in such a way that it's almost like you've got, you know, a hammer. So you can knock the. You're using those as tools to take your music to a different place, and I got to believe some of that is deliberate, no, or that you've worked on that, or
well, definitely. I mean, tone guitar. You know, the tone has been paramount from day one, and I even even from the first day, the sounds. I was attracted to certain sounds in guitars. From Buchanan with that old Telecaster. There was, you know, I mean, like, for instance, there's a Crusaders record called Chain Reaction that Larry Carlton, on like two songs on the record, his tone on those two songs really influenced me. That's been, I spent a lot of time early on trying to figure out how to make those sounds. Jeff Beck's Wired and Blow by Blower, encyclopedic tomes of guitar, the potential of what the guitar can do sonically, especially when they came out. So I personally find it hard to play, or it's not as fun for me to play with when my sound is not happening. With regard to effects, I kind of have two modes. And the first mode is really to just enhance. Like if you turn everything off, it starts there. And if that doesn't sound good, just the guitar and the amp, it's going to be a little bit of an uphill battle. And so when I add in reverb, echo, whatever, I'm generally trying to do it in a way where you're not that cognizant, you're not that aware of it. It's just giving you a subtle enhancement, and I can feel it in my hands, and I can sort of feel it wrap around me. I mean, these are sort of esoteric ways of describing it. Mm. But the other approach is to really try to find a sound that makes your head turn immediately, and you really are exploiting the effects at that point. And that is the point, is to, especially when I'm in most situations I'm in the studio, I'm layering guitars. It's a minimum of anywhere from two to seven to eight tracks. And in those situations, that's where effects really shine for me. You got to create these little sonic spaces within. There's only so much room in the stereo field. And it took me a long time to really realize how you carve out niches. And you can do it. You can leave it up to the engineer later to do it, or you can sort of commit with effects and EQ, you know, the way you EQ your amp. But I mean, there's a song on my second record called "Ain't No Other Way" where I did a solo, and it's kind of a more of a ballad in a way. And you would think, well, I would, you know, I'm going to do this really beautiful, pretty little sweet solo. And on that solo, I turned on every pedal on my board. Every pedal was on, and I had a wah there that I turned on and cocked it about halfway back. And that sound alone sort of dictated what I played. And so, you know, it's kind of two different modes for me, where one is just to enhance the foundation, and the other is to create a completely different soundscape in a different moment.
Yeah, well, I think you do that in a tremendous way that it's really unique to you. And I enjoy when you do that, because it's really cool to listen to, and you're playing things that are, like I said, leveraging the tools you have, and it sounds great, man. I really enjoy your soloing when you're doing that. You've worked with so many cool people and iconic people. I was curious for each one of these people, if you could talk about maybe three things. One, how you got the gig and the nature of the engagement. Two is maybe a cool story or two about working with them. And three is if there's any takeaways from the experience. And let's start with Mellencamp. I've seen you mention on Facebook recently that this was when it was good, this was the best group of musicians that you've ever played with. And I was curious if you could elaborate on that as well.
Well, I think what I said was when it was good, it was great.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a
there's another side of that.
It wasn't always great, but that had, I think I comment on that, you know, this was an unplugged show that somebody somehow put a link up to, hadn't watched it forever. And I was reminded of how incredible that band was and how much I enjoyed playing with everyone. And I think my next comment was, I've never, you know, as fine a group of musicians yes. ever been honored to work with. And, you know, it was a very, very unique situation. It was an extreme in my career in that John was, you know, is a very complex person, brilliant, difficult, fun, all those things combined into one, and you never knew which one you were going to get. And that made for some tension and some stress, but one of the things about that was that the band, I felt like we were close. And we were sort of united. We had to be one unit because we were asked to do a lot of things that were challenging. And there were a lot of situations where if you didn't deliver immediately, it was tense. But I've loved bands. I love bands. You know, the Beatles, the Stones, Free, Led Zeppelin. Bands, NRBQ, the Fabulous Thunderbirds, bands that had a sound. And that band was truly a band. They had a sound. And so I went back and looked at that unplugged thing. And then, you know, when you're playing acoustically, there are no effects. And it just struck me that particular day, John was in a good mood. And although he did berate me halfway through that I was actually tuning my guitar, I mean, go figure. I mean, the nerve that I would actually want to be in tune.
How dare you?
Those guys, I mean, everybody in that band was a badass. And the irony was John really didn't like the term musician. And I think he sort of resented musicians. And I think, to be frank, I felt like the whole time I was there, he didn't really like me. But I ended up playing an awful lot of guitar parts on those records. But I got the feeling, you know, he never really, you know, didn't really much like me. But, you know, maybe he didn't much like that many people. I didn't take it, you know, it is what it is. But the band, everybody was so damn good in their own way. And if you listen to those records, and I think his best records, his truly his best records he made before I got there. And I think it comes down to the songs. I think his songs were a little better than the two main records that I played on. But if you look at the contribution of what the band did, I mean, John comes in with an acoustic guitar, and it's a three-chord folk song. And you sort of then reverse engineer it to create these anthemic, timeless classic things. And the hooks that the guitar player before me, Larry Crane, came up with, that Lisa Germano, the fiddle player, that John Casella, the keyboard and accordion player on those records, you know, Kenny Aronoff's drumming, the rhythm, you know, Mike Wanchek on the other guitar and Toby Myers on bass, the way they all played together and the parts they came up with, or you can't teach that in music school. And so to that end, I do know what John was talking about. He goes, I don't want any musicians in my band, you know, but it was his genius for me. What I got out of that experience, the two things I got were understanding what it was like to work with a genuine, back when there really were rock stars, and what that was like, and how you had to sort of adjust, calibrate the way you responded to situations. The thing that I take with me to this day that was his genius, I think, was his production in the studio and the way he went about taking these three chord songs and directing people, and just watching that happen over 2.5 records was invaluable. And he really is, you know, brilliant in the studio. And so that was priceless for me to be able to do that. And also to get the chance to experience touring in a way that really doesn't happen that much anymore, you know. And yeah. I think, you know, I go from a van going back and forth across the country to I'm in a private jet staying at the Ritz-Carlton, and it was really heady stuff. And all of a sudden, I'm making some serious money, and I can buy a couple of guitars that I dreamt about when I was, you know, listening to Roy Buchanan and Allman Brothers at Fillmore East, and it was a whole other planet for me.
How much of the turmoil was attributable to youth, do you think?
With regard, you know, with my, you mean with my time with John?
Yeah, I mean, how much of that, like, do you think, because obviously, you know, everybody changes, and most people change for the better.
Are you talking about the turmoil that I was involved in, or whether
his volatility, call it that, or unpredictability?
I think he's probably mellowed out by now. I don't know, but I think that John thrived on chaos, and I think he thought that good things came out of intensity and chaos. And I agree with that to a certain extent. When it becomes there's a point at which it becomes counterproductive, and sometimes that line got crossed, and it was not fun.
Yeah, I hate chaos personally, man. I don't thrive well in chaos.
I don't know that it's. I mean, I just don't think things have to be difficult to be good. I think that. I mean, I firmly believe that the most growth I've experienced in my career has been from difficult situations. But to the idea that you're going to deliberately create an uncomfortable situation is not. You know, it might work on occasion, but it's not. When everybody, you're trying to build a team and you're trying to get everybody excited about something, if everybody's scared to death, it's not, you know.
Yeah, it's not. Stressful, man. That's what it is. It's fucking stressful, man. Yeah. Nobody wants that. The Allman Brothers. Was that like a one-off or?
The Allman Brothers, I was flying back to Austin from some gigs with John, and I'm in O'Hare Airport before cell phones. It was 93. At least I didn't have a cell phone, and I called home to check in with my wife, and she said the Allman Brothers called, and Dickie Betts is not going to be able to do some gigs for a few weeks, and they want to know if you're interested. I'm like, oh my God. So I'm like, give me the number. I'm down in from the payphone again at O'Hare Airport. I call, and I was too late. They'd already gotten somebody else. And so the next day I'm tooling around. I go back to Austin, and I'm kind of, God, I can't believe that, you know, because in high school I was in a band. We had two drummers, and, you know, we covered a bunch of Allman. We you know, that was sort of part of the Bible. Was it the Fillmore East record?
Fillmore East, yeah.
And so the next day, you know, I'm at the music store, and I get paged, and it's Shelley on the phone, and she goes, they called back. The guy didn't work out. And I don't know if you could be on a flight. And I'm like, when? And they go, well, they got you booked on a 6:30 flight. It's like 4 p.m. And I'm like, I had to race home, you know, and get my guitar and pack up. And I got on the flight, and they picked me up at the curb of, it was in D.C., whether it was Dulles or BWI, I don't know which. The tour bus pulls up the curb, and I've got my PRS in a Fender Reverb unit in an Anvil case and a suitcase. And I get on the bus, and the first person I see is Greg Allman. And the next day, they had a sold-out show at Meriwether Post Pavilion. And for about 45 minutes that afternoon, we actually did a sound check and quote-unquote rehearsal. 45 minutes. And we played the show that night. And that was the last time we ever did a sound check or a rehearsal.
Pressure.
3 weeks with them, and
Warren was in the band, but Derek was not at that point.
No,
right?
It was Warren and Dickie, had a situation where he had to take a few weeks off, and Alan Woody was the bass player, and so that was probably as good a time period that those 2.5, whatever it was, 3 weeks were, you know, as good as a time and rewarding an experience as I can remember ever having. It was, and it was a result of that time that when I got home from that, it became apparent that sort of the idea of creating chaos and if you're not yelling at me, I'm not yelling at you. All that seemed to be really ridiculous. And it was like, I rediscovered the joy of playing, you know, that feeling. The first time I heard Revolver, first time I heard Live at the Regal, I felt every night playing with the Allman Brothers. And it was not long after that I, a series of events transpired, and I was no longer playing with John, and that decision and my reaction to it was made much easier because of the 3 weeks that I'd got to and play with guys.
So that was like spiritually extremely timely and like cathartic for you to do that.
Totally.
Yeah, that's great, man. That's so cool when something like that happens. Like, you know, the universe just says, hey, man, here's a nugget. It's up to you to freaking pay attention to it.
I just can't even begin to describe what it was like. You know, that band was so important to me. And then to be up there playing, you know, the one moment each night that I can remember that was almost beyond surreal was when we would start Dreams. And I stood right next to Greg, and, you know, the organ, you know, the way that song starts, it's such a low burn and builds. You know, it was just like otherworldly. And God, everybody was so nice. And it was it was just about music. That was all it was. You know, the show started at 5 to 8. Road manager comes around and said, all right, time to go. And everybody just kind of hang out at the edge of the stage and the tour manager come out and say, "Hey, ladies and gentlemen, the Allman Brothers Band." We go out and put our instruments on, and somebody count 1, 2, 3, 4, and kick it off. And it, you know, I'd never experienced, you know, playing Elizabeth Reed or, after the first gig, Warren said, "You play longer solos." I'm like, "Well, nobody's ever said that." But
not only is this anybody, Warren Haynes is telling you to, and yeah. Warren Haynes telling you to play a longer solo. Yeah. That's not a bad, that's a one for the memory bank.
Well, I knew Warren before that. And I think that's in large part, you know, he recommended me for the slot. The other guys didn't know me. But the experience of playing Elizabeth Reed, Whipping Post, Dreams with these, you know, like literally 4 or 5 minute guitar solos for 20,000 people, and then having them, you know, like getting a big round of applause at the end of that. It's like a jazz show, you know, you're improvising like a jazz band, and then have the crowd react in the same way. It was surreal.
Man, you know what reminds me of, just listen to this. I was married when I was very young, and I was so unhappy, and I met a woman that was later to become my wife, who I've been with for 25 years, and I was just talking to her, and I was like, "Oh my God, you could have a conversation with a woman." And that's what it kind of reminds me of, your experience here. It was so diametrically opposite to the conditions you'd been enduring. It must have been like a ton of stress lifted off your back once you finally sort of got out of that other environment.
Yeah, it was a weight lifted off my back, but I missed the guys in the band so much with John. I mean, they were so great, and it was so rewarding to work with them, but it got a little toxic. And I think as time went on, you know, personality wise or whatever, musically, I mean, John hated blues. I mean, he would yell at me anytime I played anything bluesy, and I'm like, well, I don't know, who am I supposed to become, you know?
Yeah, you're a blues guy.
I mean, I have that. It's such a huge influence in my playing. And so the first record full record I did with him was called Whenever We Wanted, and it was just a guitar record. And he wanted that. He specifically wanted that. And then I think when he had time to think about it, I remember getting called up to his room one day, and I think he was going to fire me. And he went on this whole thing like, "We don't need any of that shit on this record, this next record. I need Peter Buck. I don't need, all this Texas shit." And I'm like, well, cool, man. I'm all up for for growing and doing different stuff. And I'm not married to anything. I think he was taken aback that I was like, "Yeah, no problem." And so I didn't get fired. And then we made a record called Human Wheels, and I ended up playing, you know, lots of acoustic, and it's much more textural and less, it's a much different record than Whenever We Wanted. But by the time, I don't know, I think it just got tired of me.
It sounded like it was like a blessing in disguise, which might not have felt like that.
It felt like it, and it was supposed to happen that way. But to this day, one of my biggest regrets is the way it went down was really uncool and uncomfortable. And one of my biggest regrets is not calling everybody in the band and say, "Here's what happened," because I know that the story they heard was way different than my interpretation of it. And these things happen.
Yeah. Absolutely. What was it like playing with Chris Layton and Tommy Shannon?
You know, again, another iconic rhythm section. You know, it's the same feeling, you know, with the Allman Brothers, with Butch and J-Mo, you know, standing in front of those two drummers, and it's like a freight train behind you. But Chris and Tommy, I mean, nobody plays a shuffle, a slow blues like those two guys. And, it was just listen to Texas Flood, the first Stevie record. Listen to Tommy Shannon on that record. He's like the lines he plays in Texas Flood, you know, the slow blues. And to this day, I don't think anybody plays a shuffle better than Chris Layton. And that's not all he does. I mean, he's incredibly musical cat, but it was great.
I remember listening to Tommy and digging his stuff when he played with Johnny Winter.
Oh yeah.
Great stuff, man.
Yeah.
Just tremendous.
All intuitive, you know, not schooled, off, you know, just feel.
John Mayall, that guy's, I mean, you talk about a lifetime of experience. What was it? How did that come about, and what was it like playing with him?
I played with him. I did a record with him called Wake Up Call. And the producer, R.S. Field, I'd worked with him on several other things. A lot of my favorite records that I played on. He makes great records. And he got me to play, and it was Coco Montoya was there. He was John's guitar player at the time. So I was sort of augmenting what Coco was doing. And then I did that complete record, and then did an Austin City Limits with him, which was a blast. And then he recorded a song of mine called What Passes for Love on his next record. Storyville ended up recording later, but John recorded it before Storyville did.
That must be pretty cool when, like, John Mayall records one of your songs. No,
it's really cool. It's really cool. Yeah. And that's a whole nother feeling, you know, to be acknowledged as a songwriter
by a guy who's recorded thousands of songs.
He's recorded a few good blues.
Yeah,
songs.
A couple. Yeah, just and he's recorded them with crack ace, top of the line guitarists. Yeah. Man.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Did you get anything out of working with him? Did you learn anything? Because he's been around so long.
Well, I always get something out of learning. I mean, I always learn something in every situation. You know, that session is not, it's not really at the front of my mind. I just remember that he was very... It wasn't, you know, we didn't think about things much at all. It was just, let's just play it. Let's not talk about it. Let's play it. And everything was really first, second take. Once the arrangement was established, I do remember, again, once, you know, working with Bobby Field, R.S. Field, I always learned something from him, whether it's production, sound, sonics. Again, a unique way to approach a blues song. That's the challenge to me of making a contemporary blues record, is how to not be cliched. And Bobby was really good at that, helping artists sort of reinvent themselves, at least for that record. But with John, it was just kind of, you know, like, let's don't talk about it. Let's play.
So it seems like right after the Mellencamp experience, you really did a good job of attracting, you know, the opposite in a number of different subsequent situations that, you know, gave you the freedom emotionally, playing wise, that, yeah.
Well, and there was I made a very conscious, that was a conscious decision. Mm-hmm. I mean, unlike what we were talking about earlier about, you know, creating a sound of my own, which just sort of happened, that was a very conscious decision. In fact, when I left Mellencamp, I got an offer to join Rod Stewart's band. And I had a choice between Rod Stewart or Storyville. Rod Stewart was, you know, I could go make a lot of money and play, basically in a cover band, or I can take this leap of faith and go play with Chris and Tommy and drive around the country in a van again. But intuitively, my heart said, you're going to get whether this makes it or not, this is an opportunity that only comes along once in a while. And the singer Malvern Milligan was amazing. And the other guitar player, David Holt, and I had worked together. So I just felt like, you know, that was a band that never really broke through, never really reached its potential. But the 5 years of paying dues with Storyville was invaluable. And so that was a very conscious decision. After working with John, having the Allman Brothers time, that I needed to reinvest and dig in and get back to doing things that meant something, as opposed to just taking the fast money.
I heard an interview you did in about Storyville. You said one of the reasons that you didn't feel it kind of lived up to its potential was because there really wasn't a leader.
That's very true. Yeah. And I think that there were a number of reasons. That band started out as Five Chiefs. We all could have been band leaders in our own right. And then it's just, we started out as Five Chiefs and ended up as Five Indians, where we're all, I don't know, what do you want to do? You know? And so consequently, there wasn't, you know, whether it was management or the record label or what, no one was truly driving that, was at the wheel, that could say, here's what we're going to do. Here's what we need to do. Here's how we're going to get there. And here's who our audience is. And, you know, nobody was really watching, you know, we need to make sure we've got the best production we can get on the road, which will make or break you. We just kind of just threw the whole, you know, we just kind of threw, all got in a van and went out there, and it was like,
what do you think that happened? Because if you had five Chiefs, basically, so you had five type A personalities, how come that's unusual? What do you think that happened that nobody said, okay?
I don't know. I don't know that I knew enough at the time to say that this, you know, and to say it in a diplomatic way. Mm-hmm. Which is half of it, is to, you know, that nobody was able to sort of unite the team.
Yeah.
And it's nobody's fault. It just wasn't our time. Yeah. I mean, we sell more DVDs. We did a reunion in 2006. I think we've sold more of that DVD that we made. At the last minute, like a three camera shoot, you know, it was just like an offhand thing. I think we sold more of those than we did records back when we were actually a band.
Right.
I get more emails about when Storyville getting back together. And I'm like, it's just hard. You have to be diplomatic and say, we're not getting back together. This is now.
Yeah.
People, you know, we're in different places in our lives, and it's just not going to happen. But I don't regret it. At all. I mean, I'm grateful for it.
Sure.
I became, you know, I had the opportunity to really become or think of myself as a songwriter. And I learned a lot of about what not to do. I can honestly say that I feel like I'm good friends with everybody in that band right now. And so,
which is nice, especially again, coming out of that other situation.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like a musical detox for you. I can understand why you opted for that instead of the rut. You needed, you know, emotionally to restore your faith in what the hell you even do for a living, probably.
You know, growing up, I was sort of, I don't know, the people that were, I had some mentors, or I met people, or somehow or other intuitively, I was, you know, before the term long tail was invented, I guess it was more like I had the ability to sort of see long term. And probably my biggest mentor in my career, and I know my biggest mentor was Joe Ely, and I watched him make decisions day in and day out that in the short term seemed to be mistakes, but now seeing where he is and having watched his career continue to develop, I see how wise he was, and subconsciously, if not consciously, you know, watching him go through all these decision processes and turning down certain things made a huge impression on me, and the idea of thinking long term, how is this going to really, you know, where do I want to be in 10 years as opposed to tomorrow, had so much to do with, you know, choosing Storyville over something like Rod Stewart, because I could see further down the road, this is going to give me the chance to develop as a songwriter. I'm going to be doing original music. I get the chance to play with one of the greatest rhythm sections, or one of my favorite rhythm sections that I know of. And it just, I'd love to say that I had it all figured out and that's exactly why I did it, but it was more of just a feeling. Hmm. A feeling like that this is, I want to go someplace deep. And with all due respect, playing Do You Think I'm Sexy every night was not the same as, maybe creating something really special with these other four guys.
Yeah, totally get it, man. Totally get it. You mentioned you're from Louisville originally. What was your childhood like growing up?
Well, there's sort of the period, my childhood, I guess, is divided in before when my mom was alive and after my mom was gone. And I think probably until she died it was probably pretty dang normal. My father, when I was born, was still, he was in law school on an athletic scholarship. And drove a concrete truck on the side, and basically came from pretty humble beginnings that he never failed to remind me of, and which was good. I mean, he was all about work ethic. Hmm. And so that was a great thing. So, I don't remember that much of my childhood. Especially don't remember much. I remember, after my mom died, I was 10 and I had a brother who was 7 and my sister was, I don't know if she's 6 months old or 8 months old. And I remember the people around me telling me, you got to be a man now and have to take care of your brother and sister. And
that's a lot to process.
I was a kid today and I'm like, are you kidding me? That was the counseling I got. And so I don't remember, I've talked to my father about this too. And there was like a 2-year period after that I hardly remember anything. I mean, it's like even as a kid, you have the ability to sort of shut down and just sort of get through, do what's necessary to get through. But my father, my mom was the one that took care of us and he went to work. And, he told me stories of going to work and he would, Louisville, the expressway would do a loop around the city and he didn't want to get off of the exit to go to work. And he would just drive around that loop. I mean, we were all in kind of like this, what do we do now phase. And
How'd your mom pass?
A car accident. I was in the car and we all walked away from it. But she hit her head in such a way that it caused her something in her brain. And that night she woke up in the middle of the night and she was suffocating. And my father tried to revive her and died while he was trying to bring her back.
Wow.
That's
heavy shit, man.
Yeah. It was heavy, but it's life. And, so when music came in, that's when I felt like the lights come back on. And that was really the source of my comfort. Even at 12 or 13 years old, it was almost, looking back on it, it was an escape, but it was also some sort of spiritual thing for me before I knew what spiritual meant. Hmm. And it may be that feeling that I got and the joy and the spiritual thing that I got, and there wasn't a whole lot of joy for a few years there, but when I would play, I would feel what I would call joy. And I just absorbed myself in music. I mean, it became all I really thought about.
So would you say that playing music at I would imagine early on, playing music didn't necessarily give you joy, but it just removed you out of the pain of having to deal with that whole thing. It's probably hard to get joy at any point in time, like that, after going through that as a, you know, but it probably just numbed the pain for, you know, and you got to absorb yourself in something else besides that negative, the fucking cloud hanging over your head.
Well, it was also an acceptable way to express yourself. I mean, whereas, you know, as a male, to show emotion was not cool.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't do that. Yeah. And it was about sucking it up, pulling your boots, you know, socks up and getting on with it, even at 10 years old. So music, it was an acceptable, you know, nobody else had to do how good I felt when I was doing it. And, you know, by the time I was 15, 16 years old, even, I'd gotten to where I was playing with other people. And I mean, I had distinct experiences on a couple of occasions of playing, probably playing in a solo, when I felt the presence of my mother, whether in the room or, and it was, I got goosebumps at the time, I get goosebumps now. So, I mean, that happened. I mean, it did happen. I wasn't sitting there thinking about trying to make it happen. I'm in the middle of a solo and I'm like, whoa. And
that was probably really important though, that you felt that at the time.
It was important because not only did it open a window that I knew was there, or I knew that there was like something beyond this sort of three-dimensional world we lived in, which has come in valuable in various other ways in my life too. And, you know, I was aware of something bigger than me at an early age.
But also to feel that affection from your mom was probably wonderful.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
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 Man, well, thank you for sharing all that. That's pretty deep shit.
Well,
it is. Yeah. It is what it is.
Go through deep shit, man. It is what it is. You know?
What prompted you to move to Austin?
The really simple. Everything I was listening to was happening here.
Okay.
Everything.
So you were in the blues scene. Texas blues made sense.
I was. Well, it was Joe Ely. It was the Thunderbirds. It was Lou Ann Barton. You know, Stevie. And with the exception of Stevie, I ended up playing with everybody. And then when I got down here, I mean, I was into other things than that, but I really just felt like the scene that was really happening was in Austin. And I had a friend from that moved down there, and I went and stayed with her for like 3 or 4 days. And I just took a look around and went to clubs every night. And I flew home and packed up my Honda Civic and turned back around and ended up, you know, she let me stay at her place for 3 weeks. Then I found a roommate and got an apartment and went out and started sitting in and meeting people. And I met a singer-songwriter here named Lucinda Williams. And oh, I got
big. Man, did you play with John Prestia by any chance?
No, we're talking 1983.
Well, he was playing with Lucinda way back when she was just getting started. That's why I asked.
No, I don't know him.
When you were in Louisville, did you ever run into the Headhunters or Greg Martin?
No, I didn't. And they're from
Glasgow.
Glasgow. But Greg is a friend, and what certainly a
wonderful.
Run into him from time to time.
Amazing human being, that guy.
Sweet, isn't he? Sweet guy, incredible guitar player.
Yeah.
And I remember when they hit, it was so cool because they were like so off the grid from the typical Nashville thing. And, you know, Greg was into vintage guitars and vintage instruments before, you know, We went to the same guitar store a lot in Louisville called Guitar Emporium. I was hanging out there before I had a driver's license, and I know I drove them crazy. But I was into vintage guitars really young. And, you know, he was definitely ahead of me in that regard. But he's just a great guy and phenomenal player.
Yeah, he was down here over the weekend. It was so great to meet him in person because I had interviewed him a few months ago and we had stayed in contact and we just have, yeah, you know, good chemistry because he's just an amazing human being, you know. And it was nice to meet him in person. And it was really funny. Yesterday I was listening to Paul Kossoff, some old Paul Kossoff stuff, and I heard of Greg. All I hear was Greg gets Les Paul Marshall. Yeah. Boom. That's it. You know, and it's like such a distinct period, distinct tone, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So let me ask you this. So how old were you when you moved to Austin?
I was, I want to say 23.
Sure. Let me ask you this. You've been doing this such a long time, David, and I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to maybe share, you know, we all make mistakes, pay tuition. If you could talk about maybe one or two mistakes you made along the way and the lessons that you learned from them.
You know, that's a hard question to answer, really, and not as a cop-out, because I don't really think of – the word mistake, I don't really think of – that has a real negative connotation. I've made a conscious effort to take every challenging situation, every misstep, every missed opportunity, and turn it into an opportunity for growth. And so I think their mistakes, if you will, are gifts, if you're willing to look at it that way. So, I mean, having said that, I mean, little things that I can offer up that when I first started working in Nashville, I did a lot of sessions there between 2000, 2010, like a lot. And that was a phenomenal period. And I just, there, if you break in with a producer, you sort of become their guy and get hired on. And then someone else hears about you, and then it snowballs in a good way. I had to learn really fast there. They make records really quick, yeah, really fast. I mean, like fast. I don't even know. It was faster than I'd ever worked. But the legitimate mistakes that I made early on were A, trying to convince the producer that my idea was better than his. Like, I was convinced, like, no, man, I really, trust me, this will work here.
This will
work. That was a big no-no. That was a big mistake. Kind of along the same lines was it doesn't matter how cool of a part you come up with or what you're playing that you think is absolutely cool and the entire band's looking at you with a thumbs up. When the producer comes on and says, I'm not hearing that, I'm hearing something totally different, the only right answer is, cool, I agree.
Or cool, we'll do it again.
I was thinking the same thing. Let me, so that, those two things right there, it took me about one or two times of messing that up to get that. But again, I think I've just been really lucky to have, you know, when I come to these T's in the road, the forks in the road that we all continue to get to if we're moving forward, I just sort of let my intuition guide me, and it's been the right direction. And there are interpersonal things about how I dealt with situations I would do different now. I'm a different person. But again, you learn from going through those and like, well, what happened? You know, why did that happen? And how do I do it differently the next time? And they're more life lessons than really music lessons.
Yeah, I agree with you. And as far as the mistake things, I totally get it. A number of people have come back and said the same thing. So that's not a unique viewpoint. And it's not one that I don't actually share, although I am well aware of my mistakes. Flip side of that, were there any things that you did that at the time were outside of your comfort zone that you said, I'll give it a shot, and that turned out to be really big breakthroughs?
Well, I think going back to the not taking the Rod Stewart thing, I mean, that was a big deal. And that was the one time in my career that my wife thought, I told me flat out, I think you're making a mistake. That was the one time. And she's been very influential on me, and she's a really good sounding board. So that made the decision a little more difficult. But it turned out to be absolutely the right thing to do. So sometimes I think you got to stick to your, I mean, if that voice inside you is like saying, trust me, you need to do this. This is what you need to go do to honor that. That turned out to be really, I mean, I just don't think I ever would have, I never would have, written songs with Chris Stapleton. I never would have had other artists cut my songs. I never would have done all these. I played on number one records in Nashville, and I probably would have not ever been on Buddy, done Buddy Guy records. I just feel like my life would have been totally different had I taken the Rod Stewart thing and not done Storyville. I really do. And so that was, I would have made a hell of a lot more money for however long I stayed in that gig. But at the end of the day, I've made a lot more money, and I continue to have a vibrant career to this day because of choices like that.
And you had some really quality, meaningful musical experiences that you may never have had.
I mean, almost every experience I've had since the Allman Brothers, I've felt has been meaningful in some way.
That's great. I don't know if this question's even relevant to you because you've been a PRS guy for so long. Now, the question was, what's your go-to guitar right now, and what other two guitars of yours would round out your top three?
My go-to is a PRS DGT, and it's a specific one. It's right here.
Let me just tell everybody, this is so cool to be looking. Let me just tell everybody that your room is like, it's just so cool to just look at. I can't see the scope of the whole room, but all I see is about, like, I don't know, 50 vintage guitar.
It's a snake pit in here, man.
Yeah, it's awesome in there, man.
Wires everywhere. Aside from the newer PRS stuff, everything in here is old. And, I don't know. I with the recording stuff, everything, it's almost all old. But this particular DGT is my favorite, and it has a Pernambuco neck, which is the wood they make violin bows out of.
Oh, wow.
So I've got like a few of these with Pernambuco necks, but this particular one I've just bonded with. And if the house was on fire and had to grab one guitar, it would be this one. So this is my main instrument. And then after that, it would be a Telecaster.
The vintage 52, 53, 59?
I've got a 52, and then I have a 60 that I just got that has a refinished body, which means it was like a third of the price, and I can take it on the road and not worry about it. And it's this one. It's got, I don't know who decided to paint it that color. It's,
wow, that's, I've never seen it.
Ungodly ugly.
It's like
everything on the rest of the guitar is stock. But so this, my second default thing would be a Telecaster. Again, going back to the Roy Buchanan thing, and there's something about a Tele that, I don't know. I can't even that. And then my third choice would be because I sort of, I've got a great Strat. I've got a couple of great Strats, but I'd have to go with my 335, the 59 335. So it's a combination of new and old.
Do you always play with rosewood or ebony or dark, non-maple fretboards?
Oh, no. I've got
vintage maple.
Fenders that have maple fingerboards. And I don't. I mean, I love them. Absolutely love them. And, each guitar is different. So I just have found that to generalize and say like a slab board is fatter than a maple neck is not true. Mm. I mean, it can be true, but it's not a rule. Not always true. Every guitar is completely different. And yeah. with vintage guitars, there are great ones and there are terrible ones. And I've been through so many of them and had the chance to play so many of them. It took me a while to figure that out, but just, and I just generally find that the more beat up they are, the better they sound. It's, you know, either they got played so much because they sounded so good, or they're just, you know, my best sounding acoustic guitar is a 42 Martin D18. So I didn't even think about acoustics. Now, if I have to pick three, I just picked electrics.
No, I don't know acoustics. So I don't really, yeah. I try not to talk about stuff I don't know about, which is a hell of a lot, but specifically acoustics.
I mean, the best sounding acoustic I've got is, I mean, I have a new Collings that a relatively new, it's about 10 years old, that has a lacquer, a varnish finish that sounds amazing. But in vintage wise, I've got a 42 D18 that has been literally like almost run over by a truck. It's got a replaced fingerboard, headstock break, about 20 body cracks, you name it, and it sounds unbelievable. And it was, you know, I bought it at Carter's in Nashville. They had like six pre-war D18s and mint ones all the way down to this one, the problem child. And I played them all, and this one sounded the best. And it was a fraction of the cost of the other ones. And so there's a phenomenal guitar player in Nashville named Brian Sutton, one of the best bluegrass players I've ever heard, one of my favorite players. And I just know, I remember I did a bunch of sessions with him, and his guitars were always beat up. And I'm like, there's something to this, you know, and sure enough, I found that to be the case. The mint ones, I mean, you know, it's kind of like, well, just get a reissue.
His wife, I interviewed Walter, actually. I know she specializes in those pre-war Martins. She's got a massive collection of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any cool stories behind how you got any of your guitars?
I mean, tons of them, really. I mean, they all have a story.
I got to tell you, as soon as you started talking about your guitars, your energy perked up like a like a little kid.
Well, yeah, I mean, because I'm also trying to stay close to the mic and not like roll around too far away to pick up instruments. But, you know, the only guitar I had when I moved to Austin was a Strat, and it's a 1960, it's Fiesta Red.
I love that color Strat. Oh,
yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And I bought it in 1980. And from a guy in Memphis, and the first time I saw it, he wanted $375. When I finally decided I had to have it, he goes, well, I need to get $400 now. So when I moved here, that was the only guitar I owned that I brought with me, at least. And at one point I tried to sell the guitar. And my wife would not let me sell the guitar. It's usually the other way around.
Yeah,
don't bring another guitar in this house.
Yeah.
And she kept me from selling it. And because she goes, like, when I met you, this is your guitar. And it means a lot to me. And so I still have that instrument. So, I mean,
that's really cool.
That's cool. You know, the 52, when I got with Mellencamp in 91, the first, you know, all of a sudden, I've got money. Chris Layton's calling me. I thought I put it in airplane mode. Sorry.
It's all good.
The first guitar I actually got with, making the kind, you know, Mellencamp money, I was in Tampa, and I was in a music store.
Thoroughbred? You're probably in Thoroughbred.
I think it was Thoroughbred. Yeah,
that was around back then.
And some guy that lived there was taking me around to look at guitars, and I was on tour with John, and I saw this Blackguard Telecaster, and it was up on a guitar stand on top of the thing, and I didn't even get it off the stand. I knew I had to have that guitar, because it looked just like the one on the back of Roy Buchanan's set. It had the same color and everything. I just knew I had to have it. And when I got back to Austin, I called back down there and we worked out a price on it, and they shipped it to me, and I plugged it in and I was like, it sounds like that, the first two Roy Buchanan records. I mean, it's that sound.
Which telly is it? What year is it?
It's 52. And
so it's butterscotch with the black.
Black, and you know, all nicotined out, all browned out.
That's awesome, man.
Beat up, checked, and pickups just microphonic enough. So I bought that guitar without ever touching it, just on a hunch.
Which is common nowadays with the internet, but back then it was like, what the hell are you doing?
I know. Never plugged it in. I never even felt the shape of the neck. I didn't even know what I was getting into. And and then during the same period of time, I also got a 59 Les Paul. And I don't even want to tell you what I paid for it. It was, you know, with today's money, it's laughable. And that's the one.
That, a burst? You know, a burst?
It's the 59 burst. And it was a plain top. That's the one that got away from me. You know, I just had this experience where I would take it to sessions and we'd A/B it with my main PRS at the time, and the engineer always picked the PRS. And so I sold it in about the late 90s, and I paid off my 5 acres of land that, you know, and it was a lot of money at the time, but about 5 years later, you could have put another zero,
yeah,
end of it. And that was a mistake. There's a mistake for you. Selling that guitar was a mistake. And there's no getting one back now.
You can, but you're going to pay for it.
Well, it's prohibitive. But then again, you know, when it's gone, it takes on a larger than life thing. So, I mean, how many? I don't know.
You paid off 5 acres of land. It's not a bad deal.
At the time, it paid that off, and blah blah blah. You know. So, but the other reality is, and probably the more important thing is that the 59-335 that I got kind of kicked its ass.
Yeah,
it really did. It was a guitar I play a lot, and it sounded better and kind of did the same thing.
Good stories, man. I give you a magic wand, and you can make 3 wishes, David. What are your 3 wishes?
My 3 wishes are, let's see, all right, that I get to continue to play music. That would be one. I would wish that we, for a little more love and tolerance in the world, human being to human being and for our planet. And I would wish that I could get that 59 Les Paul back.
Those are really mild wishes. Those are pretty impressive. I wish you can get that Les Paul back too. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I'm now, for 2 years, I've been a vegetarian.
Oh, cool.
And from being, I actually started eating a little chicken, but I mean, I was like a barbecue fanatic, and for various reasons, I eat some fish occasionally, but that's kind of, people that have known me for a long time but haven't seen me would be shocked at that. I collect a couple of things. I collect old stuff. Like, and one of the things I collected for a while was vintage fountain pens.
Dude. I
was like on eBay all the time. You know, when I get into something, I get into it. And, flexible nibbed fountain pens, and I was really into that. Doug Sewell, who is the amp designer at PRS, got me into it, and he's way deep into it. And he can write, he can do all the Spencerian writing.
Yeah,
and
that's pretty cool.
So I got into that, and then also I kind of like, you know, dig watches, you know, and I got in, like, I've got a few old watches and got into that a while ago. It's now become, now the whole world is into that, and so I like vintage guitars. It's like no fun anymore and too expensive. But
yeah, it's
so maybe the watch thing's not that weird, but the fountain pen thing is kind of esoteric.
You know, I was the same, and we moved about 3 or 4 years ago, and I had so much shit. I mean, I just there were nothing like I had thousands of books, and so I just like got rid of and sold off. Like I kept the fountain pens I write with, which is maybe 20. Ish pens, and
that's a lot, man. You got to keep them cleaned, and they if you don't write with them, they get clogged up, and
it's work.
That's a lot of pens.
20 pens, I had like 60 and I sold 40 and then I was like, shit, I got a lot of money for these pens. I was like, kind of,
I know,
that's pretty good. I'm glad I got rid of these, because I just became like, I don't want to. I'm only keeping what I'm using. I just don't want to have stuff. And outside of, you know, a few guitars, I don't want to have stuff.
Yeah,
stuff.
Let me know how that goes. I'm working. My whole life I've been trying to get rid of stuff. And
it's great. I like it. I feel lighter.
I love it too.
I feel lighter.
We downsized by about 60%. From my 5-acre thing out in the country to now where we live in town, and it's been a great.
Well, that's what happened with us. We downsized, and I'm like, I just got rid of shit. I don't want any stuff. Just guitars, you know, a few guitars I have, and it just feels good.
I look around the studio and I'm like, holy cow! But I can't get rid of it. I use it. I use the stuff.
Well, if you use it, then that's it. But I got rid of stuff I wasn't using. That's why it was an easy decision for me to do. The only thing I have now is like a bunch of Zippo lighters.
Cool. I mean, I like all that stuff.
Yeah, that's really cool. Hey, I want to congratulate you too. You've been with your wife a long time. I think that's a major accomplishment. That's as major accomplishment as having been a professional musician and gotten paid for that your whole life. And I don't think people who haven't done it or who didn't make it don't realize there's a lot of work involved. I think people just think, oh, they're lucky. There's no, it's work, man.
Yeah. And, you know, people that have known us for a while or that meet us and like, you know, you've been married 32 years. The automatic assumption is wow, everything is perfect. And it's like, no way.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so easy to throw in the towel. It's so easy to fall into that trap of, God, or you meet somebody and like you make this story up in your mind about what they'd be like. And the truth of the matter is it's really not what they'd be like. It's about like, what's my part in this whole thing? You know, like you can get divorced and remarried 40 times. And if you don't change you or whatever, if you're not happy in a relationship, if you don't work on yourself, you're going to repeat the same thing over and over again. But I can honestly say that, you know, I mean, it, just like anything worth doing or worth continuing to do, it's work, but, it's been worth it. And, I think we both know, we both have a deeper sense of gratitude for that, is really, really, if not the biggest blessing in my life, it certainly is now.
Hmm.
You know, that we didn't throw in the towel.
Yeah.
And I got a partner.
You talked about it's about what you're like, not about what they're like. You got sober, you said, about, what, 11 or 12 years ago?
11 years ago. Almost 11. And if I make it a couple more days, it'll be 11 years.
Awesome, man. Congratulations. You got a lot of big, good things that you've accomplished. Going back to that Joe Ely long term.
Yeah, I don't want to take too much credit for it. I just somehow or other realized that it comes with the profession, especially if you're on the road a lot. And I've spent, you know, at least 25 years on the road most of the time. And I could see that it was going in a bad direction really fast. And a lot of people in this, you know, that do what we do, decide enough is enough at some point. And luckily, I mean, I had some experiences that were like, it was like blatantly obvious that, all right, you got out of that one. Next time you may not be so lucky. And it was just it's funny because I know from being around people that have gotten sober and stayed sober, we all have a little different story, but there's a common thread that runs through it. But, you know, nobody told me I had to stop. I didn't lose a job, but man, it was just going bad really fast. And by the grace of God, I pulled the plug on it. And, you know, that is more than anything else in the last decade has changed my life. And again, just like staying in a relationship, it's not for the faint of heart. I mean, it takes work. And, you know, stopping drinking is just the beginning.
Was that your drug of choice? Alcohol?
Alcohol. It was alcohol. Yeah.
What was bottom for you? Or the bottom that triggered you to stop?
Bottom was I started to have blackouts then I started to have them on not too many drinks, and I could tell that my liver was not functioning up to, you know, the way it was. And, you know, I was never a mean drunk. I mean, I did some stuff that was kind of stupid, but I functioned fine for years. I mean, it was self-medication. I look back on it, you know, like, and all that, you know, it goes back to being 10 years old or before that, who knows what. You know, I knew that if I could have a drink at the end of the day or 10 drinks, you know, whatever, yeah. that whatever anxiety or depression or discomfort or disease or discontentment I was feeling at the time, you know, I just knew that at the end of the day, we're all going to chill out and everything was going to be fine. And that was the extent of it for years. But when I started, you know, I had a couple of experiences of that, you know, I don't want to get into drunkalogue here, but it just was blatantly obvious to any reasonable person that, you know, like, I'm not drinking like a normal person.
Yeah.
And coming off the last Dixie Chicks tour, which was kind of dark, it was 3 years. The first tour I did with them was 2003. And then that was the first gig was the English gig where, you know, they said the thing about Bush and then all hell broke loose. And 3 years later, it was still going on and it was just a different vibe and didn't seem like it was just, you know, I just was just drinking real heavily on that tour after the gig. And then when I got home, continued to drink like that at home and realized that, you know, I've kind of lost control of this. I'm no longer running this show. And, luckily quit.
That's a pretty bold admission to your, you know, when you know, you need help, you know, you're no longer running this show. I need freaking help.
It's the worst. Yeah. I mean, you get to the point where it's like, you know, I can't imagine living like this the rest of my life, but I can't imagine not having a drink tonight.
Yeah. That's a tough thing to reconcile, I would imagine.
It's like you're left in this no man's land of like, well, what's left then?
And you have to come, and I think it's a tough, the pain of continuing is worse than the long-term pain of continuing is worse than the short to medium-term pain of stopping. But that's a hard, that's why bottom is generally pretty low, because that's a tough decision to come to.
Well, there was some stuff going on in my head that I also considered to be part of my bottom, you know, that was pretty dark. When you think about can't live with it, can't live without it. And that was part of the bottom too. But I honestly feel like if I had kept on that, I was not going to be here. You know, at some point I was either going to drink myself out of here or I was going to kill somebody with a car, or, you know, myself. Who knows what? But, you know, I'd love to say that I would. It was all me that did it, but I had to turn over a lot of control issues and a lot of power, and then realized that I didn't have that this is the one thing in my life. It was the one thing that I couldn't beat. And, you know, I had gotten to where this place in my life where kind of surpassed what I thought as a kid I could do or what might happen. And, you know, that was by sheer hard work and self-will. And that did not get me anywhere when it came to not drinking. I had to surrender. And that was a whole nother concept of me, was like, you know, why can I not beat this? You get ahead in this world by gritting your teeth and working harder than the guy next to you. But getting sober and staying sober doesn't, that's not what it's about. It's the opposite. It's turning it over and saying, I can't do this and I need some help.
That's a tough thing to do.
It is.
Really tough thing to do. Especially if you pretty much grew up independent, especially after your mom passed and you were forced to run the show.
Yeah.
Good, bad, or indifferent. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute. Yeah, that's a tough thing to do, man. Well, I'm glad you did it. I'm really happy for you, and glad we get to have this conversation. Wouldn't have had that.
I'm very, very grateful for it. Don't take it for granted. It's a one day at a time deal, man.
What's the favorite part of what you do, and the least favorite part?
The favorite part is undoubtedly when I get to play with my band or play on records. And it's all clicking. Those, you know, when that's happening on stage, you know, in a live situation, when you're improvising, or when you're in the studio with great players and you're cutting as a band, and the energy, you know, it's like, let's get there. We need to get this now, and it's all happening. There's nothing like that energy. It's my least favorite part is the administrative stuff, scheduling. Dealing, you know, chasing down money from distributors or people you license stuff to, or, you know, all that. The stuff that, you know, then in a perfect world, I'd have an assistant or an intern that would help me with, but I don't, and it doesn't make any sense for me to right now to have them.
Can you set up these agreements such that if they, like, if they're not paying you what they're supposed to pay you in a timely fashion, that the agreement terminates, they no longer have licensing rights?
Well, probably could have done that, but I didn't. And, you know, I actually vetted, you know, I did some vetting and got good reports. It's just a challenging time out there right now.
Well, I guess too, the problem with that is if they're not paying you beforehand, they don't give a shit if they don't have the licensing right. They're still going to sell the.
Just, you know, but I get, you can, you know, turn it into a tax benefit. You know, you can write it off. I mean, and I could sell my receivables to somebody else.
But it's a pain in the ass nonetheless. All the shit you have to do. Yeah.
It's a pain in the ass, you know, but you try to not to let it. I mean, I do have compassion for the people that are, they're doing their best to try to make this work. And in some, I do find that you can definitely catch more flies with honey.
Yeah.
And, as you know, the last 11 years, I think I'm a lot easier going person, you know, I've learned to respond rather than react, and that gets you a lot further down the road.
Oh yeah, for sure, man. I was going to ask if you have hobbies outside of music, but I guess we kind of cover those between your vegetarianism and fountain pen and watch collecting. Anything else?
I wouldn't call vegetarianism a hobby. It's just a lifestyle thing. The pens, watches, and I like to read a lot. I really, really like to read.
What kind of books do you read?
Mainly novels, not, you know, fiction, historical fiction, not that much nonfiction.
You ever read Haruki Murakami?
Yeah.
Guy's amazing, isn't he?
Amazing.
He's just
Amazing. I've written, you know, 4 or 5 of his books.
It's incredible.
Yeah, he's into fountain pens too.
Yeah, he is.
I love his writing. You know, The Wine of Bird Chronicle, I think, was the first one I read, and I thought 1Q84 was brilliant. And his book, he wrote this book with, I think it's Seiji Ozawa, talking about music.
I haven't
Conversations about music. I've read part of that. I haven't finished it. And what we talk, what I think talk about when I talk about running.
Yeah, that's a great. Yeah, that's awesome. That's
fantastic.
Yeah, I love that book. He's, you know, that he has the ability to take you so. I mean, if you just like broke down any one of the weird things going on in his book, you'd say it's not believable. But within the context of the whole, he's so brilliant, man. How he can do that?
I think he's, incredible.
Yeah, very, very great.
I love that being transported.
Yeah,
and it's the brilliance of, you know, and you know too. I mean, there's certain writers, you know, as a songwriter too, to read, you know, something, a great someone who writes like that, and there's hundreds of authors that you could list, is really inspiring too. There are books I read, I find myself just like reading a paragraph and having to set the book down. I'm like, how did they do that?
Yeah.
That's staggering.
Another guy, I don't read a lot of novels, but the other guy I read that is, I've read, not all of his books, but Jonathan Lethem. You ever read any of his books?
The Corrections. I think he didn't he write that?
The ones I read, Motherless Brooklyn. That was.
I'm thinking of Jonathan Franzen. No, I didn't. I have not read him.
Yeah, he's a good. Motherless Brooklyn is phenomenal. And he is another one. I can't think of it, but he's a good writer. What's the most important lesson that your business has taught you?
Think long term. To me, it's just a question of wanting to build something. I want to build something that I can continue to do. I don't want to have a 2 or 3 year meteoric arc to this thing. I mean, each day I wake up, one of the greatest things, I mean, I get to do it again. And it's because I have thought long term, and you know that it's that, you know, I've built relationships. I've tried to be someone that you want to continue to be around and hang out with. I've tried to be accommodating in the way that I work, respecting people's, you know, it's a service industry.
Yes.
Really, it's a service industry. And I, you know, so I'm here for, you've hired me, and I need to give you what you want. But again, you know, those choices that I had as a professional musician, you know, which gig do I take, which gig do I turn down? Those are really, really invaluable things that are hard to you know, somebody like you could articulate it better than me. But for, you know, in my experience, it was the watching a true artist like Joe Ely day in and day out, how he conducted himself. It's that sort of ingrained itself in me and shaped my decision-making process.
Thanks. Let me ask you just one more question, then I'll tell everybody how to get a hold of you. And, man, this has been a pleasure talking to you. I really mean it.
Likewise.
What's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years? We kind of talked about it a little bit, but
the biggest change, well, is that I approach music, and I think most of my life, in a much more easygoing way, and it's much less about how can I, you know, put another notch on my career post, but it is much more about how can I bring joy into the room? How can I honor the people that I'm playing with? How can I honor the artist I'm working for? How can I honor the people that come to hear me play? I get much more satisfaction out of bringing a sense of joy or transmitting that gratitude that I feel I get much more, that's just much more meaningful to me than, like, you know, having people tell me that I'm great, you know, and some of that comes from having had a, you know, a certain degree of success, and I can say I've done this and I've done that and I've played with so-and-so and, you know, so I've sort of done that, but it really comes down to just, it's like a lot less about me and more about what can I share, and that's a huge difference.
And I would imagine much of that is driven by becoming sober, because that's came from a narcissistic to more of a connection. Yeah. Yeah, which is great in so many different ways, man. I'm happy.
Yeah, addicts, alcoholics, you know, are incredibly selfish and self-centered people. That's a characteristic, that's a personality trait of the disease. And part of to stay sober, to stay, it's easy to stop, but to stay stopped, you got to change the way you think, and you sort of turn things over, and what can I do? You know, the quickest way to feel, like, you know, if I'm having a down day or I'm bummed about something, the easiest way to the remedy for that is to turn my thoughts to somebody else I can help, or pick up my phone and call a friend and say, "How are you doing?" You know, instead of like, me, and that it's definitely that's the people that I've seen, my mentors that have been able to stay sober, that's how they've done it, and it that has everything to do. If I hadn't gotten sober, I'd still be the same guy if I was still here.
And thank you for everything. I really appreciate it. Let me tell people how they can find you, and then maybe you talk about some of the stuff you got coming up. So you got a new record coming out this year. You're going to go to Italy, and you do a lot of tracks out of your home studio. You want to talk about some of those things?
Yeah. I'm trying to finish writing the new record and get it out. And, you know, a big part of that is what we goes back to earlier. You know, I'm attracted to sonic imprints, I think, sounds and textures. And so I find that once I find the sonic imprint of this record, what it wants to be, I'll finish writing. I've got about half of it written, and it's kind of taken on a shape. So, you know, it's been longer than I care to since my last record, but I hope to have it out. But this year, I'm going to do some dates in Italy, I think, with Matt Schofield and Jeff Mackerlane. I love going to Italy. I'm excited about that. I've really put a lot of energy into doing more studio work in Austin, and a lot of that has picked up, and I'm doing a lot of stuff at home. People are sending me things. It's just so easy to do that now, and I'm able to, you know, I've got all my stuff here, and I get the best sounds, guitar sounds here at my house, as good as any other place. I just finished doing a record with Rita Coolidge, which was awesome. I went to L.A. We cut it at Sunset Sound in L.A., and the rhythm section was Bob Glob and Brian McLeod. And, you know, it's just, it was so juicy. Those guys are just the epitome of, you know, what groove and soul. And so, and she cut one of my songs, a song I wrote with Chris Stapleton. I think it's gonna be the first song on the record. That was a great,
awesome
experience. I'm going out in February. I'm doing a bunch of shows with Charlie and Bruce Robinson and Jack Ingram. They're all kind of combining to do a bunch of shows. And
where are those going to be?
There's a couple in Florida, and the rest of them are in Texas right now, but it's like 15 shows.
Where is the information going to be? Where can people find this? On davidgrissom.com?
I should put that up on my website. I don't normally put up gigs I do with other people on my website. But, you know, if you're a fan of Charlie or Bruce Robinson or Jack Ingram, they all have all the dates up. And I do my regular residency at the Saxon here every Tuesday, almost every Tuesday, when I'm in town, which has really been my big outlet for the last 5 years. you know, again, the priorities are to finish the record. And at the same time, I love playing on records, and I love to do it at home has been really cool. So
where can people connect with you if they're interested in hiring you to do some tracks?
You can go to my website, davidgrissom.com, and if you hit contact, it comes right to me, and I make my very best effort to get back to people as quickly as possible. And I'm open to doing that. I do it for all sorts of people, and if you don't like it, I'll give you your money back.
There you go.
I've not had anybody ask for their money back yet, so.
Money back guarantee. There you go, from one of the best guitar players in the world. That's a pretty good proposition, I think.
Better be careful then.
Hey man, thank you for your time. Everybody check out David online. It's David Grissom, GRISSOM.com, and he's just a hell of a nice guy. Any final words of wisdom?
practice a little bit every day. I think if you pick up your guitar for 15 minutes a day, that's better than practicing once a week for 2 hours. But just pick that thing up every day, and you know, there aren't any shortcuts, but keep it fun, and good luck.
Thank you, man. Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening. I really enjoyed this. I hope you did as much as I did. If you didn't, go to the doctor, because you probably don't have a pulse anymore. Thanks again to David Grissom for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. And go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes, along with some cool stuff we're going to roll out soon. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, and I am out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.